Walaikum salam.
It's salam alaikum, means peace be to you, and the response walaikum salam is and to you be peace. So salam alaikum. Kids are a really tough act to follow. I'm still in love. They're so awesome. What a beautiful way to bring them into community and giving them space. So as you've heard Warren talk a little bit about our relationship and how long we've known each other. So that's at least 20 years. I asked him what he wanted out of my talk, and he said, I don't know. I've only been here for a short time. I don't know what they know, or what experience or what exposure they have of Islam or of Muslims. So if I'm going to be saying stuff that's too trite and too obvious, forgive me. If it's over your head, forgive me. I'll try to find some middle ground somewhere. Hopefully there'll be something in here that resonates and speaks to you. I'm going to begin with the first chapter of the Quran. So just as an introduction, the Quran, Muslims believe to be the revealed word of God. So these are not the writings or the teachings of Muhammad, but God speaking through the mouth of Muhammad over a course of 23 years, and these recitations, and the Quran means the recitation, were compiled in their current form, or in mostly their current form, during the lifetime of Muhammad. And the opening chapter of the Quran is called the Fatiha, or the opening. I'll recite it in Arabic. I will share with you the... A little bit more. Is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Thank you. I will recite the verse in Arabic, and then I will share with you the interpretation that we use at the Toronto Unity Mosque. And what I forgot to do is to make a note of my time, because I can ramble on and preachers all day. I don't want to do that to you. So, in the Sufi or the spiritual community that I belong to, any verse of the Quran that we recite, we first recite what is called the Salawat, which is a call on God to bless the Prophet and the family of the Prophet. And it goes, there's many different versions of it. The version I use is Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ali Sayyidina Muhammad. God's blessings on Muhammad and on the family of Muhammad. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Ar-Rahmanir rahim. Maliki yawmiddin. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين آمين. I take refuge with God from the one who tempts us away from the truth. In the name of Allah, the tender, the compassionate, the infinitely merciful. Praise God, nourishing sustainer of all the worlds, the tender, the compassionate, the infinite, the merciful, possessor of the day of awakening. You alone we serve, and you alone we turn to for help. Guide us on the path of illumination and discovery, the path of those who accept your sublime guidance, not the path of those who are overshadowed by anger, not the path of those who wander away. So these seven lines are understood by many Muslims to be the summary of the content of the Quran. It's quite simple. Right? You celebrate God, you praise God. And who is God? God is the tenderly compassionate, the infinitely merciful, the Rahman and the Rahim. I started the prayer with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So in Islam, we don't have images of the divine. We have no physical representations of God. God is known to us, God reveals God's self to us through to the 99 most beautiful names. So we recited the prayer of light. Well, light is one of God's 99 most beautiful names, Nur. And as are Rahman and Rahim. And both of these words come from the same root in Arabic, Rahma, which is also the same root for womb. So you can understand that this compassion, this tenderness, this mercy of God, the God that is these things, is like a mother's womb, nourishing, protecting. Everything that you can think about a mother's womb is manifest in these two ismas, these two names of God. Right? This is not an angry and a fiery God. Though some of the 99 names are also that. So God's 99 names are divided into the names of Jalal and the names of Jamal, the names of majesty and the names of beauty. And some people even understand these to be the masculine and the feminine manifestations. But again, this is us projecting our limited capacities onto something that is beyond our capacity. Right? So we all grapple as people of faith to find a connection to our divine. In the Christian tradition, it is through your own symbols and your own representations. In the Muslim tradition, it is through these ismas. Right? Many of you have heard of Rumi, yes? Many of you may not know that Rumi was a devout Muslim. And that the path that he taught is a path that is in the tradition of Muhammad. And a lot of Muslims believe that his writings, the Mathnavi, is the exegesis of the Quran. Right? But it is something, I think, for many Westerners, and even for many Muslims, something that's a little bit more approachable than sometimes the text of the Quran. Rumi's teacher and also his father-in-law, Shamsi Tabriz, had this to say. The words we use for the Creator are a reflection of ourselves. If we think of God with fear and shame, we are scared and have something to be ashamed of. But if we see love, compassion, and kindness, it is because we possess these qualities, these attributes. The pursuit of truth is conducted by the heart and not by the mind. Use your heart as a guide, not the head on your shoulders. Be one of those who knows his devil, not one of those who kills him. Don't search for heaven and hell in the future. Both are now present. Whenever we manage to love without expectations, calculations, negotiations, we are indeed in heaven. Whenever we fight hate, we are in hell. It's a long paragraph. I just want to focus and revolve the first part, which is we all talk about in our traditions how we are made in God's image, but we also make God in our own image. And so we can pick our God. And so in Islam, that's really kind of easy because you've got these 99 names. And so you have everything from the giver of life to the taker of life. And which is it that you're going to celebrate? We have choice, as was pointed out to the kids and to us. We have choice. Right? And we have choice all the way through. So I guess part of my message today is that just as Christians are not a monolith, and as a Muslim, I've been horrified to be witness to what we're seeing in the media, especially down in the United States right now with the killing that took place at the school. And I've been following on Facebook, much to my horror, how people are calling for the survivors of that massacre to actually be injured and killed because of their opposition to gun violence. A lot of those people call themselves Christians. But they're not the kind of Christians, I suspect, that are sitting in this congregation today. And so you are similarly, we are all similarly also fed images of Muslims doing terrible things in the world. But there's 1.5 billion Muslims on this planet today. And if our religion was a religion of hate, and if all Muslims were prone to violence as part of their religious tradition, you wouldn't be sitting here today.
That's true.
And I wouldn't be speaking to you today. We're one in four. We're one in four. And so the images that we have that are fed to us, yes, those are real images. But do they represent the fullness of the Islamic tradition of 1,500 years of history? And do they represent every Muslim and every Muslim theological understanding, interpretation, and practice? No, they do not. No, they do not. However, what is truth is that all of our traditions, and particularly those of us who follow the Abrahamic traditions, but I think it's a fairly universal human truth, that our societies and our cultures and our traditions and therefore our interpretations are vested in patriarchy. And patriarchy may have served its functions, but I think that function is long gone. I share with you my views. You don't have to, buy into them. But for me, as a gay man and as a gender non-conforming man, patriarchy imposes roles on people based on our genitals and on very little else. And what it does, even to heterosexual cisgendered men, it says you have to be this way, and if you are not, you're not fully a man. And it says to cisgendered heterosexual women, you have to be a woman this way, and if you are not, then you are not fully a woman. That's a lot of pressure to put on people. You have this option or you have that option, and there's nothing in between, and there are no shades of gray. But that's the reality for a lot of people. We live in a society, and with our economic and social affluence, we have more options. But also poverty robs people of options. And the vast majority of people on this planet live in and with poverty. So as a gay man, I also call myself a feminist. Because I have seen how religion, and particularly my religion, is used not only to persecute and to dehumanize queers, but also 51% of the global population. And ironically, most of these interpretations and understandings come from men, because men have traditionally controlled our religious traditions. So the United Church is really on the cutting edge, right? Most of your clergy are female, a lot of them are queer. It's fabulous. It's a very comfortable place for me to be at. And in fact, I am doing my master's in pastoral studies at Emmanuel College. It's a nice fit. And while our beliefs may not always be identical, and they shouldn't be, because that's not how God created us, there is a verse in the Quran where God says, I created you from male and female, and I created you into different nations and tribes so that you may know and learn from each other, not despise each other. And elsewhere in the Quran, God tells us, I did not create you all to be the same. If I had meant for you to all be Muslim, I would have done so. Right? So it is in our engagement with our differences, the celebration of our likenesses, and in the engagement of our differences, that there is growth. Right? So for me, the United Church is a place where I don't necessarily share all your beliefs, but I think we share a lot of values. And I most likely share more values with people in this room than I do with other people who are Muslim and who go to other mosque spaces. And that's all right. They are entitled to their choices and to their freedoms. So my work with the Unity Mosque and my work in this growing movement within Islam for a more inclusive manifestation of our traditions and a more inclusive understanding of our traditions, because the movement I'm in, at least with people like myself, it's not that we're trying to recreate something or find something that's not there. In fact, all of the stuff that I speak to you about is within my tradition. It doesn't come from outside. But maybe it's a tradition that was prevalent or an understanding that was prevalent over there or practiced by this community or understood by this community. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to reclaim a lot of these traditions and centralize them and bring them to the front and say, you know, this is not the only understanding of this verse, or this is not the only practice, and that there are also these variations and so on. And so what is Muslim belief and what is Muslim practice? There are five pillars. And again, I'm giving you kind of a generic Islam. So there are Muslim traditions, Muslim sects that will hold that there are six pillars or seven pillars and so on. But most of them will agree that these are five, and then they may have others that add on to it. And the five pillars are the declaration of faith. The declaration of faith is La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah. The first part is the foundation. There is no God, but one God. Muhammad is the messenger of God. I belong to a Sufi community, which is Sufism is the mystical tradition in Islam, and one of our exemplary teachers is Rumi. The declaration there is no God but one God is first a negation and then a submission. And many of us understand that the no God, the small g God, refers not to just deity, but the gods that we create: money, material wealth, children or sons in traditional cultures. These are all gods. And so our love of the divine, our love of our creator has to be the God that we embrace. And so the Muslim declaration of faith is to proclaim that there is only one God. Whether we do that and how well we do that in practice, that's a whole other narrative, right? A whole other sermon. And then the declaration that Muhammad is the messenger of God. And I'll come back to the question of prophets and what this statement means in a moment. Regular prayer. Most Muslims worship with a particular prayer. There might be additional prayers that they do that have developed over the years, but most of you, if you watch television or movies, you will, you know, hear the call to prayer, and then you'll see these Muslims bowing and so on. It's always amazed me that most television and movie shows just never get our prayers right. Always do them wrong. And they're not that complicated, like seriously, they're not. But we pray in the example of our prophet, because the Quran says, pray as I have shown the prophet to pray. And our traditions tell us that the angel Gabriel taught the prophet the prayers. Yes, we have Gabriel too. The zakat is not charity. It is our obligation to society. And it is payable on your annual wealth. And it's not just on your earnings, but on your possessions. So, for example, women who have jewelry, men too, but let's talk about women. Who have jewelry. If you don't wear your jewelry and you keep it under your mattress or in the bank, you have to pay the zakat on that. And I think that's because we're not supposed to be hoarding, that we're always supposed to be feeding our society. So if you've got all the stashes of gold jewelry sort of hidden away and you're not wearing it, it's just stashed away, you gotta pay on it every year. Right? It keeps money circulating. And it's not a charity, it is your obligation to the society that you live in. It's your obligation. Fasting in the month of Ramadan, Ramadan is one of the 12 months on the Islamic calendar. The Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar. And it is not in sync with the, some other lunar calendars have a mechanism where they sync it with the solar calendar after a certain number of years, and so it balances out. The Muslim calendar is 355 days. And so our dates change on the Gregorian calendar, change by 10 or so days every year. So I remember fasting in Ramadan in December, and I remember fasting in Ramadan in June. It poses interesting situations for Muslims, particularly in the West. When I was articling many years ago in Vancouver, I had forgotten to tell my principal, the lawyer that I was articling for, that it was the Eid festival, the festival to mark the end of Ramadan. But because it was lunar, and that was a much more traditional community, they actually went out to see if they could see the moon. And only if they saw it, was it going to be Eid the next day. Okay. And so I left him a note saying, I may or may not be at work tomorrow, because it may or may not be Eid, which is kind of like Muslim Christmas. but if the moon is sighted, I won't be here tomorrow. But if it is sighted, if it is sighted, I won't be here tomorrow. But if it's not sighted, I will be here tomorrow, but I won't be here the day after that. So he kept that pinned up on his door for years, because he said he had never seen anything from here. For me, it was just trauma, because I just never knew which day to take off. So many of our communities have moved to calculation, which works really well. We also believe in the angels, and Gabriel is God's messenger to the prophets. And so God spoke directly to Moses, and he spoke directly to Jesus, and he spoke directly to Muhammad, but to a lot of other prophets, Gabriel was used as an intermediary, and Gabriel also spoke to Muhammad as well as an intermediary. And so the first verse of the Quran, revealed verse, is when Gabriel comes to Muhammad when he is meditating in a cave just outside of Mecca, and says, Iqra, read, recite, or proclaim. So the thing with Arabic is that a lot of words have multiple meanings and nuances depending on context. So read, recite, or proclaim are all appropriate translations of the word Iqra. And Muhammad was not literate. So he says, his reply was, I cannot read. And again, the angel, this voice in the dark that's squeezing him, says, Iqra. And he says, I cannot. And again, the voice says, Iqra. And our traditions tell us that the weight of this experience was like he was being crushed and he was sweating. And finally he says, what shall I read? And then the first verse comes. So we also believe so it's fasting in the month of Ramadan. And so we fast in the month of Ramadan because that's when that first verse was revealed. And so we remember this gift from God with this practice of purification and self-discipline. And then the final of the five pillars is the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj, which every Muslim should do if they are able. And the interesting thing about that is that I think that it was actually designed to be like the first United Nations, so that people would come from all parts of the world, all skin tones, all ethnicities, all languages, and all with different manifestations, understandings, and practices of Islam, and they could come together in this birthplace of Islam, and so people could actually see, wow, there's Muslims, I'm from Albania, but these folks are from China, and these folks are from Zanzibar, and these folks are from wherever, and we're all Muslim, but we're all kind of the same, but we're also all kind of different, right? So it's that supreme melting pot. And I don't have enough time to sort of tell you about Mecca, but the city of Mecca was actually founded by Hagar, and we read her name in the hymn that we sang, beautiful hymn, by the way, and thank you for that, for having that on your service role today. But she is the founder of the city of Mecca. And when Muslims go to Mecca and they do the Hajj and they run between these two hills of Safa and Marwa, we were actually running in her footsteps as she ran to find water for her baby. That's after Abraham left her and her child, apparently on Gabriel's instructions from God. But there's a whole, that's a whole other veil of patriarchy in the sermon. And so when she runs between these two hills, and she finally cries out, just as Jesus cried out from the cross, what happens? The angel Gabriel responds to her. And our traditions tell us that where his wing touched the ground is where the well sprung from. And that well still, that spring still flows today. And the water from it, they don't know the source, but it provides water for millions of pilgrims every year, and it's been flowing for 5,000 years. Okay. My time is almost up. So I'll tell you very quickly about my mosque. There is a line in the Quran where God says, I am closer to you than your own jugular vein. I am closer to you than your own jugular vein. It doesn't say, O Muslims, or O Muslim men, or O Arab Muslim men, it says to the whole of humanity, I am closer to you than your own jugular vein. And so some of us understand that to be that great equalizer. God has the exact same relationship, our Maker has the exact same relationship with every single one of us, no matter who or what we are. No matter what faith we profess or not profess, no matter our orientation, our gender, our class, what our bodies look like, what our skin colors are, it's us that has the choice. Again, we go back to our choice. How we exercise our choice, what choice we exercise, what relationship we choose to have with each other. In our creation stories, we're told that Adam, the first human, not the first man, the first human, that God taught Adam the names. And so in the path, in the tradition that I follow, the names refers to these 99 most beautiful names, but these are human beings, in the tradition that I follow, it is believed that human beings are the only part of God's creation, the only creature in God's creation that can manifest all of these attributes. Everything manifests some or one of the attributes of God, but only human beings have the capacity to manifest all of these attributes. And so, I am closer to you than your own jugular vein is about how we find that journey back to these 99 attributes, how we can actually be in God's image at all times. And so if we recognize that God is within all of us, no matter who or what we are at all times, then the way forward is easy. We have to create a world which is just and which is loving. Because everyone and everything is an emanation, is a manifestation, and is a part of God. And so our true worship of God can only come through, and go back to the first verse of the Quran, you alone we serve. And so when Jesus said, I was naked and you clothed me, and I was hungry and you fed me, it is this articulation of this tawhid, of this unity, of this oneness, not only of God, but of all creation. And so the movement, the Sufi tradition, the mystical path that community that I belong to, and my work with the Unity Mosque, is about finding that unity between our inner and outer selves. We profess one thing, but we don't always manifest. And so the Islam that I share with you today is the same Islam, is the same tradition that people are calling upon to kill other people even while they are in worship. And this is also a Christian history and a Christian fact. Right? Apartheid in South Africa was justified, as it was upheld as a Christian belief. So our religions, our traditions have been used to perpetuate great injustice. But we have a choice as to what we do with our traditions. Because while God has created us in her image, we create him in ours. And so here lies our challenge as people of faith, as to how we can embrace the whole of humanity and the whole of creation as part of ourselves and part of one family. And so the Toronto Unity Mosque, we've been operating since 2009. We meet every Friday. Everybody's welcome, even United Church ministers. We now have several, I think, five or six affiliate communities in Canada and the United States. We have resourced similar communities in South Africa, in England, in Malaysia, and in other places. And just as the Protestant Reformation started in people's parlors and in people's in drinking establishments, well, Muslims are not supposed to drink, so we'll leave that one aside. But that started in people's homes and in small gatherings and so on and so forth, and it started small, and yet today it's transformed the world and it's transformed people. And so we're at the beginning of our, I don't want to use the word reformation because it's not quite a reformation. For me, it's actually going back to our traditions rather than recreating our traditions or reimagining our traditions. But there is an opening of the heart that has to take place. And so and these movements have taken place before, but we're at a really interesting place in human history because we can now communicate with each other and see what's happening around the world in an instant. My 85-year-old aunt phones every day on FaceTime to talk to my son. Not to me, but to him. And it's instantaneous. And this wasn't there 10 years ago. And so our capacity to communicate and our capacity to hurt but also to learn is so much more amplified. And so we're really at the cutting edge of where we go forward in the world. Right? We talk about climate change. If we don't change, there won't be any change. Right? And so this is a very interesting time. And maybe the notion of choice has never been more significant than it is today. And so I'm here to share the choice that I and many people like me are making. And I thank you for opening up your hearts and your pulpit for me today.